Welcome to Talk World Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk World Radio, our guest is Anel Sheline, and she is a research fellow in the Middle East program at the Quincy Institute. Previously a foreign affairs officer at the U.S. State Department, where she worked on human rights in the Middle East. We will have links up at Talk World Radio to her recent writing at the Quincy Institute. Anel Sheline, welcome to Talk World Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So forgive me, it sounds like a bit of a contradiction. How do you work on human rights at the U.S. State Department? And then why did you resign?
Yeah, so to be clear, I was only at the State Department for a year. I had previously been at the Quincy Institute, where I was very happy to be able to come back to after I resigned. And I'm someone who was already fairly skeptical of U.S. foreign policy. And so when State reached out, because I'd had an Arabic language fellowship and so owed the government a year, at first, I wasn't necessarily all that interested, but it did seem like an opportunity to get to work on the issue of human rights and to kind of see how the sausage is made. What I took away from it prior to October 7th was the marginalization of human rights within U.S. foreign policy. Obviously, President Biden had talked about how foreign rights were going, or how human rights were going to be central to his foreign policy, and that was absolutely not the case. And again, that was clear to me working on these issues long before October 7th. In the aftermath of October 7th, it became clear to the rest of the world as well. I tried to do what I could on the inside. The State Department does have the dissent channel where people can express their opposition to policy. It is taken seriously. It's a formal process. I submitted, I co-authored a dissent cable. I signed two other dissent cables. Blinken himself admitted that there have been dozens of dissent cables about the Gaza policy, which is more than any other issue since this mechanism was set up in the context of Vietnam in the early 70s. And I think just over time, it just became clear that trying to work on this from the inside was having no effect. And so I had made clear internally that I was going to resign over Gaza once my year obligation was complete. And then it was in conversations with colleagues who said, please consider resigning publicly, that I decided I would go ahead and do that. My hesitation was that I just hadn't been there very long, and so I really didn't think anyone would care. In the end, it did end up getting a fair amount of attention. And then subsequently, there were additional resignations, people may remember. So I resigned in late March, at which time there had only been Josh Paul had resigned quite early on, within weeks, because he was actually overseeing the weapons going to Israel and could no longer be a part of that. And then Tariq Habash, who's Palestinian American, resigned as a political appointee from the Department of Education in January. And then I was the next one in March. And then you started to see more and more, I think, again, as it just became clear what exactly the U.S. was enabling Israel to do inside Gaza.
I guess I've had two of the first three of these good people on this program. I need to get to the rest of them. When you say colleagues encouraged you to resign publicly, these are colleagues who shared your concerns but didn't themselves want to resign, right?
Yeah, so there were so many people inside the State Department who were just horrified by this. But it's not easy to not have a job in this country. I felt very fortunate because I hadn't been at State all that long. So I was able to come back to the think tank sector. I have an academic background. For me, I knew that in my own professional network, that people I respected, I knew that they would support me in doing this, in calling out this policy. Whereas for many people who work for the U.S. government, that is the extent of their professional network. Many of them have they spend their whole careers inside government. And so burning those bridges It's not only about will they be able to find another job. I think it's also just this sense of, their whole network, all the people that they know and respect. So on the one hand, I can kind of see the difficulty there. On the other hand, I do think you do have to draw a line somewhere.
For all of those many months, the big demand, of course, was for a ceasefire. And now, finally, there's something, at least somewhat substantive, called a ceasefire. And I myself admit to being very confused as to exactly how it happened and what it's going to mean. What is your take on that?
I mean, it is such a relief that there is a nominal ceasefire. It has been violated multiple times. Israeli forces have murdered innocent Gazan civilian people in Gaza, civilians, even in the context of the ceasefire, sort of similar to the nominal ceasefire that is allegedly holding in Lebanon, and yet there have been multiple violations. At the same time, you're right, like the situation in Gaza has been significantly improved by this, what is essentially thus far a hostage deal, the release of some of the hostages held inside Gaza, in exchange for the many, many, there are thousands and thousands of Palestinians held hostage, many of whom have no reason for being held at all by the State of Israel. While on the one hand, I am deeply relieved to see, the images of joy of people in Gaza, of people streaming back towards the north part of Gaza, which has been so completely annihilated. But at the same time, I don't think it's going to last. I think essentially what we saw here was, which has been reported on, the fact that this was the first time the US side, when this was coming from Trump and Trump's envoy Witkoff, was actually using any kind of pressure on the Israelis to say,
What
look,
was
Trump
that
said he
pressure?
wanted a deal. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry to interrupt. What was the pressure? Because we spent all these months saying, just stop sending the weapons, just threaten to stop sending the weapons, just no more weapons. Like, and we all thought we had the key and we were geniuses and we knew what was needed. And now every news story says Trump applied pressure, but not a single news story mentions the slightest threat to stop sending the weapons. So this is one of my big questions. What is the pressure that was applied?
I mean, I think the thing is that under Biden, there was never actual, there were no real threats to stop weapons. I mean, the pause on 2,000-pound bombs was such a tiny drop in the bucket compared to the vast amounts of money and resources that the Biden administration was sending. And so, whether it was Blinken or other members of Biden's administration, they adopted the air of a supplicant, sort of begging Israel, please let in aid, please stop killing so many civilians, as opposed to Trump coming in and making, I mean, again, it's not clear. I don't think it's been publicly reported what exactly, what was their quid pro quo, like what was said exactly in that meeting. But I think the point being, Israel relies so heavily on the United States for 70% of its military capacity. And much of the rest of that comes from Germany, that Israel cannot fight this war. If Israel cannot continue, as a military power without this direct involvement of the United States. And so it doesn't take that much from the US side to say, no, we really mean it. And I think the point is Biden and his people never really meant it. I mean, to put that, to sort of demonstrate that there was the letter that Blinken and Austin sent in October, making clear to Israel that they were in fact blocking aid, which should have rendered them ineligible to receive any more U.S. security assistance because of the Section 620I of the Foreign Assistance Act, that a country blocking U.S. humanitarian aid is not eligible to receive security assistance. And this letter that they sent made clear that that Israel needed to allow in more aid, and that they had, a deadline which conveniently fell after the election. And this, at the time was seen as just an attempt to maybe try to appease members of the electorate who were unwilling to vote for Harris over the Biden administration's policies, which has now become clear was a huge component of people's hesitancy in voting for her. But almost immediately you had someone within the administration acknowledging like, well, but we're not actually gonna withhold weapons. Like, sure, we sent that letter, but like that doesn't mean we're going to change anything. So again, this notion, Biden just never actually was serious about shifting, doing anything other than providing almost everything the Israeli government wanted. Whereas Trump, again, whatever it was, however the conversation ended up going down, I think made clear that he did expect there to be a ceasefire in place by his inauguration because he said that he was going to be able to accomplish that. And, it may have been simply that Netanyahu sees Trump as a bigger ally than Biden, which is somewhat astonishing given the amount of support that Biden provided Netanyahu. It may just be that Netanyahu knows that Trump won't be pushed around the same way Biden was willing to be pushed around, or that there was some kind of deal made. It's unclear.
But we know some of what the deal was, and it was 100% Trump being pushed around. It was, I'm going to let you have the weapons that Biden wouldn't. I'm going to let you go green light ahead. Anything you want to do in the West Bank, no sanctioning any criminal actors in the West Bank. It was all carrots. It was no sticks. But then the story in the media outlets is all Trump stood up, Trump was tough, Trump insisted on meeting on a Saturday, he didn't give a damn, like all vague nonsense about him thumping his chest and being tough. But the details are all gifts to Netanyahu, not punishments of Netanyahu. So this is what confuses me.
I mean, I think the reason from Netanyahu's perspective, I mean, my understanding is he is concerned that his government could fall apart. He has Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who were holding it over his head that they would leave, they would withdraw from the coalition, and that would mean, that Netanyahu would have to go through new elections, and he would potentially then be subject to the various legal cases against him for corruption and other, this could very much land him in jail. And so from his perspective, the willingness to agree to a ceasefire, that was the cost. That was it wasn't, I mean, certainly there were carrots as far as withholding the sanctions against extremist Israeli settlers or, allowing in the one the 2,000-pound bomb. Again, it's so minuscule. Like this idea that Biden wasn't providing Israel with massive amounts of weapons. Like when you look at like graphs of the amount of money and the amount of weapons that Biden sent to Israel, it is completely unprecedented. So this the narrative that Biden wasn't giving Israel everything it wanted is ludicrous. Again, I think the concern is from Trump's perspective, he got the ceasefire, such as it is, in time for his inauguration as he wanted. Now the question is, what comes next? I don't think that he has any particular commitment to maintaining it now, except perhaps to the extent that he is looking for some kind of deal, in particular a Saudi, Israeli normalization deal. Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia has made clear, at least his current position, is that Saudi Arabia would not normalize with Israel without the creation of a Palestinian state with East Jerusalem as its capital. Which, to what extent he would stick to that, it's unclear, but that is the position he staked out.
When we were speaking with Anil Sheeline from the Quincy Institute, when we think about ceasefires, some of us tend to think of that as a step toward a lasting peace, not just a pause to reload. And yet, Trump very quickly started talking about ethnically cleansing the entire population of Gaza into Egypt or Jordan, as if the idea had never occurred to Biden or Netanyahu and was a brilliant innovation by Donald Trump, which doesn't strike me, and I think doesn't strike a single person living in Gaza as a solution. So what's going to happen there? And if that doesn't work, what's going to happen next?
Exactly. Well, and I think in terms of the pressure Trump is using, obviously Trump has frozen all foreign aid, in other than that going to Israel and to Egypt, interestingly. But Jordan, which does rely fairly significantly on U.S. security assistance as well as some economic aid, that's all on hold. And my understanding is the idea Here is largely any sort of foreign aid that was going to, whether it's issues related to gender or to human rights or to the environment, those are the things that won't be coming back online, unfortunately. Those are obviously very important programs, and you know, the way that the impact that could have in the long run, I think is could unfortunately be quite damaging. But I do imagine that other aspects of the US sort of foreign assistance portfolio will come back online once it's sort of gone through this review process, this, you know, to remove any sort of DEI, for example, as the boogeyman of the hour.
Right.
And so again, I don't think that Trump plans to withhold US assistance to Jordan or other countries in, you know, indefinitely. But I do think it is a reminder to the Jordanian government and to other governments, the extent to which their continued, in particular in Jordan, you know, King Abdullah, Jordan has been dependent on a foreign sponsor since its creation. First, it was the UK, and now it's the US. And so this is a way for Trump to remind Abdullah of that and to perhaps force him to accept Palestinian refugees, whether it's from Gaza or from the West Bank, which again used to be part of Jordan. Israel seized the West Bank in 1967. And you know, the Israeli-Jordanian peace treaty that was signed in 1994, sort of in this moment, you know, the Oslo Accords had been signed in 93, and King Hussein of Jordan was a little worried about getting sort of left out of, you know, if there was the creation of a Palestinian state, which it seemed that Oslo was going to produce, Jordan was ready to move forward with peace with the Israelis. But a key provision of that is that Israel will not displace Palestinians into Jordan, that Palestine is for Palestinians and Jordan is for Jordanians, even though half of the population of Jordan is actually of Palestinian origin. But if Israel were to violate that portion of the peace treaty and displace Palestinians into Jordan, Abdullah would be in a very difficult position. He would either have to respond to this violation of the treaty, which he'd be unlikely to do, or he'd have to just accept it and then deal with the domestic consequences, you know, the popular unrest, the you know, which I've argued, and I was in Jordan last fall, and there was a significant concern about this and the destabilization. I mean, this could even take down King Abdullah's government. And so the question there is, Trump said he wanted to achieve some kind of grand deal. He said he was going to bring peace to the region. So, you know, destabilizing Jordan is definitely not a step in that direction.
So if he brings ongoing war or wider war to the region, what's the response going to be, not just from your former colleagues in the State Department, but from the US public and the public around the world? Are people going to be disheartened and dispirited? Are they going to understand that movements can take a long time and various phases to succeed? Is there going to be ongoing protest and resistance and resignations and lawsuits? What do you see if Trump turns out to be the disappointment to peacemakers that I'm afraid he may?
And I agree with you that I'm not holding my breath for him to end up being a peacemaker president. At the same time, I do think that he's really plugged into a general dissatisfaction from so many Americans with the endless wars, you know, these unnecessary endless wars in the Middle East, whether it's Iraq or Afghanistan. This is part of what America First is supposed to mean, is, you know, moving away from sort of this neocon agenda of the US policing the whole world and promoting, you know, in trying to promote democracy at the end of a gun. I mean, obviously, hopefully, it seems that those lessons have somewhat stuck, that it's not possible for the United States to engage in nation building and sort of transform some of these other countries. At the same time, I do worry, you know, just I'm based in Washington, D.C., and sort of seeing the foreign policy establishment and the ways that some of these figures that championed things like the war in Iraq continue to hold key positions of power across whether it's a Republican or a Democratic administration. And they control key think tanks and institutions. It's, you never really suffer any consequences for advocating for a truly stupid foreign policy, something like the invasion of Iraq, for example. To your question about more resignations, I mean, we saw a series of arguably higher profile resignations under Trump. Even people like the undersecretary that I served under, so it was Rezaia, who became the undersecretary for DRL, the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor that I was part of. I mean, she resigned under Trump and then got this plum position in the Biden administration. I think those of us who resigned under Biden, I don't imagine any of us will be hired by a Trump administration, nor an incoming Democratic administration. So I do think there may be people who resign under Trump and see that as a way of sort of signaling their loyalty to Dems the next time the Democrats control the White House. Whereas again, those of us who spoke out on behalf of Palestine, it has been difficult for some of those colleagues who've struggled to find work. And again, I feel extremely lucky that I was able to come back to a think tank job.
It's just full of contradictions, it seems to me. Trump, of course, wins over people who are desperately searching for the more peaceful candidate and don't see it in Biden. But wasn't he going to end the war in Afghanistan last time? And wasn't he going to end the wars in Ukraine and Gaza before he even got into office this time? And hasn't he put a bunch of these old warmongers back in the cabinet and back in power? And doesn't he have a secretary of war who, in his confirmation hearing, said he wanted to kill every member of Hamas, and not a single senator even asked, who does that include? Is this going to be is this just election madness that people think they've somehow got enemies of endless wars, or is there going to be something that comes out of it? Because demanding that 5% of economies go into war preparations is not your typical recipe for, decreasing war making.
Right. And as we've already talked about a bit, I mean, there's a deeply entrenched military industrial complex that drives a lot of policies in this town. And, Congress, the vast majority of the members of Congress are paid off by it. So, it's more powerful than the Israel lobby, although that is also quite powerful. And so, it's those lobbies, those individuals, those entrenched interests that are now being sort of met with this more sort of populist America First, some of which is more grounded in this notion that it's not in America's interest to fight unnecessary wars abroad. We should be spending less money lining the pockets of shareholders for, Raytheon and Boeing, and more of this money should be going to the American people, or just, from the libertarian perspective, just the government should be spending less money in general, including on the Pentagon. So I do think that at least under Trump, there's a little bit more of a conversation about that, whereas I think the concern under both Biden and a hypothetical Harris administration would have been a doubling down on this sort of liberal hegemony. The United States has to maintain its military primacy because we are the ones fighting for the liberal international order. And, even though we're not actually fighting for actual international institutions or international law, but, we are the ones fighting for democracy alongside our good friends Saudi Arabia and Egypt, and
The people who we have just a few minutes left, Anil Sheline, and people who wanted to hold them to those pretenses, now look at a government that doesn't even make the pretense, that has a secretary of so-called defense who openly says, toss out international law, get rid of the Geneva Conventions, figure out how to kill more. And so what should people do? Aren't we going to see a so-called reconciliation bill that's more money for military, less money for everything good, and get rid of whatever taxes are left on corporations and the super wealthy. I mean, it seems like packaging all the worst things together into one bill, and this is going to be the agenda to ram through with only 51 votes. What should people do who thought they could at least try to hold those hypocrites to their pretenses last time around? Now, what do you recommend?
I mean, it is extremely disheartening. But I do my hope is, obviously right now there's still so much finger pointing going on with, why did the Dems lose the election? And I hope that those who identify as more progressive or more anti-war would be advocating for either existing Democratic politicians or people thinking about running in the future, to plug into this the anti-war sentiment, which I think is growing. I think more and more Americans are just so frustrated with the corruption, with our foreign policy being dictated again by these huge corporations that just want to make money hand over fist and, make money, meaning from our tax dollars. And so I don't I'm not necessarily, again, not necessarily optimistic that that will happen. But I do think that Trump plugged into something there, which is real, and it's part of why people either didn't vote for Harris or maybe even voted for Trump, seeing him as sort of the less hawkish candidate. And I just hope that Dems will tap into that and realize that electorally they need to reflect that in who they're putting forward as candidates, because it is something that Americans want.
Just about 1 minute left. Prime Minister Netanyahu faces arrest if he goes to certain countries, and certain countries have an obligation to arrest him. Shouldn't his weapons dealers be indicted as well? Shouldn't Joe Biden and Blinken be facing similar problems?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, on the one hand, I do think that the context of the war in Gaza has demonstrated how ineffectual our international institutions are, but at the same time, it does have everyone talking about them. And potentially there's momentum there to argue that things like the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court need to be more powerful and need to actually be able to constrain rogue states, even if the superpower is trying to protect it and prevent it from facing any kind of accountability. So I hope that although it's been extremely disheartening to see the ways that the whole world has, voted at the UN General Assembly, for example, trying to rein in Israel's genocide of Palestinians and has been unsuccessful, that this may prompt countries to work together to say we need to reform some of these international institutions. We need something that's more functional, and that, one country can't just prevent the sort of the implementation of the will of the rest of humanity.
Very well said. We've been speaking with Anel Schielein, who resigned from the U.S. State Department and is a research fellow in the Middle East program at the Quincy Institute. Anel, thanks for what you're doing and for coming on Talk World Radio.
Thank you for having me.
This is Talk World Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. Read or listen to today's Peace Almanac entry at peacealmanac.org. All past shows can be heard at talkworldradio.org. Talk World Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.